The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, let's see. Good evening, everyone. Welcome back to our last class. So, as people are still coming in, we can once again begin with if anyone has any questions or reports about meditation practice, if you'd like to share that. Or ask. Yes, please.
I had a question, not actually about meditation practice, so I guess you could save it for later, but I was wondering if we're interested in learning more about Buddhism, what you think is a good start. I know that there's a lot going on here at the center, and what you think is a good entry and a good way to start learning more.
Well, it depends what you mean by Buddhism. There is no Buddhism, really. So you have to kind of like a vague idea. But if you what you mean is meditation practice, then I think a lot of what goes on here is supportive of meditation practice and mindfulness practice and bringing mindfulness into your life. So you can look at our schedule, and if something works for you, there's all kinds of, you know, it's just a Sunday morning, the Monday evening, the Thursday evening, Tuesday morning, Wednesday morning. We have, if you want to get more involved in some of the application of some of the particular teachings of Buddhism into your life, then once a month on Fridays we have something called Dharma Practice Days that go from 9:30 to 3:30, and that's there's some teaching, there's some guided meditation. There's some exercises, there's a lot of discussion, a chance for lots of discussion of often with other participants to explore particular topics and integrate them into your life. If what you mean is more like understand Buddhist teachings,
Buddhist teachings,
then some of the talks that are given here that I give, you know, are could be called explicitly Buddhist talks, you know, talking about Buddhism. And sometimes they're not so, but you know, they're not Buddhist, but you know, I don't refer to Buddhism that much. But we have connected to IMC. There's an organization called the Sati Center for Buddhist Studies, and it's a separate organization, but it uses the building here, and that was set up to offer more classes on Buddhist teachings, Buddhist scholarship, Buddhist history. And so you can see at the Sati Center's website, they have various offerings. And so in a few weeks, there's a class, day-long class on Buddhist art that goes from ancient world right up to the contemporary Buddhist art and expressions of it. So, and then in April, there's a very famous scholarly American Buddhist monk who's going to come and talk about some aspect of the teachings of the Buddha in a little more scholarly way. So that's a place to get that.
Great.
So yes.
That was my question.
Also. Yes, up here on the stage.
I'm wondering if you could explain again the difference between investigating an emotion and analyzing it. It seems really easy to slip into analysis.
Yeah. So the difference between investigating and analyzing an emotion, it seems very easy to slip between them. Yes, it is. Analyzing is more discursive, where you're actually thinking about trying to understand it in a more conceptual way. So, I mean, very clear would be investigation is always about the present moment. What's happening in the present moment to really... understanding usually analysis of emotions usually has to do with the whole history around the emotion. You know, someone said this, this is what happened to me, and because of that I had to do this now. And it can be valuable, helpful to analyze and look back and understand that way, but that wouldn't be mindfulness, because mindfulness always keeps us in the present. So in investigation, that's why we use the word investigation. So investigation, it doesn't matter why you're angry or why you're happy. What matters is that you look more deeply into the experience of anger or happiness in this moment. So you might discover there are physical sensations that go along with it. You might notice that you have a relationship to it. You like the happiness and you don't like the anger. And so there's a for and against movement going on, not only in the mind, but also in the body around it. You might notice tension around something, or you might notice belief systems connected to it, all operating in the present moment. Not, you know, my parents taught me to believe that anger was not okay to have, and therefore all my life I've trouble with anger, and here I'm have trouble with it again. That's a useful insight to have, but that would be more the analysis, the understanding. So the difference between present moment and the historical context, is that helpful? And also the investigation in mindfulness practice, one of the guidelines for investigation is to use your mind in such a way to help the mind become stiller or calmer. And analysis usually makes the mind more active. And so if your mind is, if you notice your thinking getting more active and more involved, then it's probably not useful for purposes of meditation. Whereas investigation is like, what do I need to pay attention to now here so that I can be more okay with the experience, so I can be more settled on the experience? So can I look more deeply at this so I can be more settled, as opposed to, let me look more deeply so that I could spin out.
My question is about the noting process.
Yes.
And I've found that the more specific I allow myself to be with noting emotion, so distinguishing irritation from anger, from sadness, from other feelings, yeah, the more ease I'm able to,
yes,
feel. The more specific I think I get about thoughts that are arising, so sticking with something like planning,
uh-huh,
is helpful. So I thought being more specific, planning about this or planning, yeah, about that, would bring the same effect, but it tended to engage far more agitation and,
yes, I would think so,
thoughts. And so I was wondering if the teaching was different about noting different forms of experience, thoughts versus emotions.
Well, the instructions for the mental noting is making a very quiet one-word thought in your mind that labels or acknowledges the experience kind of, but generally but what it actually is. For those people who weren't here, so if you're sad, you might notice sadness. If you're happy, you note happy. You might do it a few times. And if you're thinking, you might note thinking. So you're using your thinking mind to help you kind of step back and be free of the experience rather than your thinking mind do whatever it does and might keep you entangled. So the principle around mental noting is to note the direct experience you're having now. And so when you're saying I'm planning for my trip, once you've got into for my trip, you've got into concepts. And so you're starting to step away from your direct experience right now. But planning is direct. So probably why it's not useful for you to be more specific is because you've started to drift off into concepts.
Thank you.
I'm just wondering is another reason, or another way of putting it, if you say planning and then for my trip, then that gets, is another way of saying it, that gets you into the specifics of the trip, and then that leads you further down.
And also because it then reminds you of the trip and about getting that bus ticket and, yeah, what happened last time you got a bus ticket and how.
So the planning, when you say plan, the noting is just a way of labeling something and setting it aside, and by saying exactly what it is, it's pulling you into the actual.
I think that's great. Yeah. Yes, that could work that way. And some people use mental, there's different purposes for mental noting. Some people use it in order to put something aside. If you fully acknowledge something or more fully acknowledge, it's easier just to put it up on the shelf and say, I don't have to deal with that. Kind of, it's been acknowledged and stuff. And some people use the mental noting as a little bit of an anchor to stay present. So say that you're planning. And if you just simply know planning, it can be almost like planning and we'll get to you later. This is not the time. So it'll put you up on the shelf for later. So acknowledged and you realize, make a decision. Whereas perhaps you're you're feeling irritated. And you can't just put your irritation aside because it kind of lives in your body, it's churning away, something like that. And so there, you might want to spend a little bit of time actually being with the irritation and not putting it aside. And then you might say, irritated, very quietly, calmly, as a way of keeping you close to it so you can really be and sense it and feel it. And so two different functions. One is to put aside, one is to keep you there. And in different circumstances, different choices are made for what the purpose of the noting is. Make some sense? So, okay. So, I want to offer you an ancient Buddhist analogy for the human being, for you. And that is, in this analogy, the human being is like a one-room house with five windows and a door. So, and the five windows are the five senses that we think of, five senses here in the West, so the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and tactile, I guess. And then the door is what in Buddhism is the sixth sense, which is that organ of perception allows you to know what goes on in your mind, your inner life. And it's usually considered important, so it's kind of the door rather than it's the window. In this one-room house, there is an easy chair. And you get to sit in the easy chair. And you sit in the easy chair, and the windows and doors are open, and a bird comes by and lands on the windowsill and takes off, and you sit there and watch. The neighborhood cat comes to the door and looks at you and meows and scampers off. You look through the door, you see a deer walks by. You look through a window and the mountain lion walks by. You look through the window and out in the street you see a friend go by, and then you see an enemy go by. But you just stay in the easy chair and allow the different sights and experiences to come. You're safe, and things just come and appear at the window or the door, and they go away. And then it's not you're not arranging or for what's going to appear next. What appears next is just, who knows, the timing of why the cat comes or the bird comes or something. That's so one mode is to say stay in your easy chair. Another mode is every time something appears at the window or the door, is you get out of the chair and you go over to investigate. Even better, you go get up to try to catch it. So the first mode is more relaxing. Nothing has to happen. You don't have to do anything with what you see out the window or the door, but just see it and stay relaxed in your chair. The other mode is much more active. It's going out in to do something. So the approach of mindfulness, of meditation, is more like the second, of the first of being in your easy chair. You don't have to go looking for anything. You don't have to grab anything or make something happen. You can just stay relaxed, and all kinds of things will happen to you as you're sitting there. If your eyes closed, you might not see much, but if you have a visual thinker, you might see images might appear. Or you might hear sounds around you. Or there might be smells occasionally. We don't have it too much here, but, there might be an insect that lands on your skin. And so you have this tactile sensation. More people have probably gotten concentrated in Asia, in Thailand, doing mosquito meditation than a lot of other meditations. You do hearing, you hear that. You're sitting there minding your own business, and then you do listening meditation. And then you do touching meditation. You feel little feet walking around. See, touching, feeling. And then you don't feel anything for a while, and you know what that means. And then you hear, and then you feel, and then, as it goes away after it's drunk what it needs to drink, and then you feel a little itching there. And by the time the mosquito is gone, you're really present. because you're not thinking about, you know, all the different things you could be thinking about, because, you know, this little mosquito has got your attention. So who knows what's going to happen? You sit there and things happen. And the idea is you're not necessarily in control of the neighbor sounds and sounds the neighbor makes or whatever. And so you would stay in your easy chair, and in your meditative awareness, oh, there's a sound, there's an itch. If it is a mosquito, it's advanced training to stay there. And it's possible, and it's actually a very good training to not get, you know, caught up about the fly walking across your lips and just feel it. Because it teaches equanimity, it teaches a strength of character, strength of mind, to just to stay and be present in a good way. Did you have something? Yeah.
I'm going to request that someone do car moving meditation, if possible. I believe it's a gray Toyota with Nevada plates is blocking a neighbor's driveway across the street. If anyone's got that car, great. Thank you.
So sometimes you have to go up to the door and take care of things. and not, of course, stay in your easy chair. So part of what meditation involves is also noticing when we have a tendency to get involved and leave our calm and ease to get reactive to what goes on. And that's a very important area of training in meditation, is to see. And so we can learn how to step back and stay calm with whatever arises in meditation. And to learn to be calm about whatever arises in meditation is a direct learning of how not to get caught by your reactions out in regular life. Make some sense? So, shall we try it? Now, if you take too much of an easy chair approach, you might fall asleep, you know, physically. It's usually recommended you don't, you know, take this analogy too far. So, taking an upright, alert, but comfortable posture. And then gently close your eyes. And take a few long, slow, deep breaths. Feeling your body from the inside as you breathe in deeply. Relaxing as you exhale. And then letting your breath return to normal. Take a few moments here to scan through your body to see if there's any obvious places in your body that you can relax. Any obvious holding that can be softened. The muscles of the face. The shoulders, shoulder blades, it can be helpful to soften the belly. And then as you kind of scan and feel your body more generally, can be also helpful to let your body, set your body at ease. Some people brace themselves in some subtle way. The whole body is braced against life. See if you can let yourself be easy in your body. Even if you're uncomfortable in some way, ease up on that. Be easy with it. It's okay. And then see if you can let yourself be at ease in your heart with what you're feeling. And if you're feeling some way that's uncomfortable, maybe be easy with that. Ease up on that. It's okay. And then if in some ways you're uncomfortable in your mind, let yourself be easy with that. See if you can put your mind to ease. It's okay. And then within your body, as part of your physical experience, let yourself tune in to the experience of breathing. First, by just noticing what your breathing feels like, how it is to be breathing now. In whatever way your breathing's okay, be easy with it. Just notice. When you exhale, see if you can let go of whatever thoughts have come in. There's nothing you need to think about except being present for your breathing. And see if you can let, in a sense, your breathing be your easy chair. Breathing easily, staying with your breath. Trying to hang in there with your breathing. Letting go of your thoughts. But then if something more compelling arises at your windows or your door, stay in your easy chair and just acknowledge it. Note it, be aware of it. Let it arise at the window and let it go away as it does. Something stay for a while, something stay for a short time. But see if the image of staying at ease in your easy chair can help you not to get involved or be reactive to what happens. All you need to do is to know it, to be aware of what's happening. And if nothing is compelling, then be with your breathing. Let the experience of breathing be the thing that centers you focuses you, helps you to let go of thinking and getting settled. If something's happening that's taking you away from the meditation, makes it difficult to meditate, acknowledge that fully. Take a moment or two to meditate with that, as if it's not a problem, just something else to know. To know without thinking about it or figuring it out. If it's in the body, feel it more fully. If it's an emotion, feel it in your body. There's a lot of thinking. Maybe there's a way of feeling that too in the body, feeling the emotions that underlie it. Nothing is a problem for mindfulness meditation. If we learn the art of clearly and freely acknowledging it, seeing it, knowing it as it occurs. There's what's happening, and then there's how you're relating to it. Are you lost in it? Are you reacting for or against it? Or are you simply aware in a very simple way? The goal of meditation is to be aware, simply aware. Being aware from your easy chair. We'll continue sitting for another 2 minutes. And these last couple of minutes, see if you can be at ease. At ease with your breathing. Be at ease with whatever is going on. It's not going to last forever. Just here for now. Breathing in and breathing out. One breath at a time. And then you can end this sitting by taking some long, slow, deep breaths. Feel your body. And then with some mindfulness of how it's done, you can open your eyes and end the sitting. So I hope that in this course that I've taught you, that you get some beginning sense of how the goal of mindfulness, the basic goal, is to learn how to bring a relaxed awareness, mindful awareness, to the full range of what we can experience as human being. That there's nothing outside of what we can be mindful of. And for me, I was introduced to the mindfulness meditation when I was in Asia. And I can still remember very clearly the day when I was in a monastery in Burma, the moment where I realized that I had the ability to be mindful of anything that I experienced. If it was an experience, I could be mindful of it. And the moment I realized that, I became really happy. And the reason I became happy was that I realized at that moment that if I could be mindful of it, of an experience, I could also be free. And so that meant that in theory at least, I could be free in any experience I found myself in, no matter what was going on. And that made me so happy. It wasn't like I was free already, but I knew the path. I had seen something that was very meaningful. So in that regard, I offer you a Buddhist teaching that some people find it kind of mind-bending a little bit, or you know, liberating or something. They say in Buddhism that at any time at all, or there's only six things happening. That's all. It's very easy. In case you're confused about your life and what it's all about, there's only six things happening, ever. you're either seeing something, hearing something, tasting something, smelling, touching something, feeling something with your tactile sense, those are five, or you're knowing something that's going on inside in your mind, your thoughts, your feelings. That's it. Doesn't that make it easy? That's all there is. Six things. Now, of course, the details are, you know, within that, you know, can be complicated if you want to get involved in it. But the idea in mindfulness meditation is not to get involved in the complexity of the details, but just stay that simple. Just, it's just a sound. As opposed to, there goes my neighbor again. It's just a sound. And how do you relate to that sound? Here comes an emotion. Oh no, this means that. I'll always be whatever. Then you've gotten involved. There's just an emotion. And I'm experiencing emotion now. Thinking. There's a knowing of the thinking. There's only six things you can know. The details, you know, maybe are complicated, but it's only six things. So I say that to challenge you a little bit, hopefully in a good way. The idea is to keep the meditation simple and not get complicated, not get too involved. And it's enough just to recognize at those six windows and doors, hearing, smelling, tasting. You know, sometimes for the inner door of seeing the inner life, you can do thinking, you can do feeling, emoting. You can break it up a little bit, but you know, it's pretty basic. And the reason for this, keeping it this simple, is to help us stay in the present moment, and to help to see what our experience is from a little bit different perspective than how we normally see it, which is all the meanings and this drama and the stories and identities, the issues that we bring into play. And as we kind of relax those, all that kind of conceiving and thinking, it's easier for the body and mind to relax. And it's easier to learn how to not cling, not to hold, not to be attached, not to be for and against. It's easier having the experience of peace. It's also easier to begin seeing more deeply what this experience of life is about. So I hope that you have a little sense from this course, this idea that we're trying to bring mindfulness to all aspects of our experience, as opposed to saying some part of our experience is the right experience to pay attention to, and some things we're not supposed to be happening now. I'm meditating, that's not supposed to be happening. It's all okay, just something else to be mindful of. And as we're mindful of it, try to stay relaxed about it. Just see it clearly and be relaxed. It's okay. Does that make some sense? Any questions about that? Yes. So we have the mic up. It's coming.
Once music starts in my mind,
yes.
Should I pay attention to my music or try to stop it, or just listening to the music?
Music is kind of an interesting one. The general advice around inner music, people start singing songs to themselves or hear music. The general thing to do is just to note it, like you would everything else, just to hearing, just, you know, to inner hearing, but to hearing. And then just come back to your breath and try to ignore it. That's usually advice. If it's really persistent and it doesn't want to go away, then sometimes you want to turn towards it more fully, to see what's going on, to be present more fully. And sometimes if there's a lot of persistent music, the songs going over and over again, sometimes it's just habit. People have a habit of something. But sometimes it can be connected to certain emotions. And then if you understand the emotions, maybe the emotion is what needs attention. So for example, some people have a lot of music turned out. If they kind of stay there with it and be mindful of it for a while, they see that the music is an attempt to soothe oneself because of anxiety. And so what might be more useful to pay attention to is the underlying anxiety, so that can settle down. So generally the advice is just to note it, be aware that's happening, and then put it up on the shelf and continue with the breath. And if it's in the background, just let it be there. But if it's strong enough that it seems to come in all the time, then you want to look more carefully, and just like you would. It's kind of a thought, in a sense. And so then the instructions that we gave on mindfulness of thinking. So, is there an emotion that's connected to it? Is there energy connected to it? Is there any physical aspects in the body connected to it? Just feel it and be with it and see what happens.
I'm kind of perplexed about the being mindfulness in any situation, and you know, the how you're saying kind of being the chair and watching versus taking action.
Oh, yeah.
And being action oriented.
Good. This idea of the easy chair was primarily meant for meditation.
Okay.
That's where we don't have meditation is a time and place where generally we don't have to act. You know, unless the house is burning. Mm-hmm. You know, then maybe you should get up and do something. But the idea is to this is a time where we're relating to our experience in a very different mode than the action and doing and fixing mode, and to see if we can get deeper into our experience that we can't get to if we're always fixing and changing and judging. So meditation is the place to just be. When you leave meditation, then it can still be useful. That way of practicing, that way of being. There's many situations where you're actually better off just being relaxed and being mindful and aware of what's happening than fixing and arranging and changing. So you can probably imagine there's places that's better. And there are places where you're supposed to do something. Like when I had a small kid, right? My two small kids, they're outgrowing their diapers now, but I wasn't supposed to, you know, say, look at that. You know, not only did they poop, but it spilled out. Wow. But, you know, mindful, I'm aware. it's ridiculous, right? So in a situation like that, it's obvious, you know, some situations are obvious that you act. Some situations are obvious that it's best not to act and just be mindful and be receptive. And then there's the gray area of when it's not so clear whether you should act or not act. And there's no simple guideline for how to figure that out. It takes a lot of wisdom. It takes a lot of life experience. And it takes a lot of, you have to use your common sense, you have to use your intelligence. Sometimes you have to reflect a lot, sometimes use your intuition. So I can't give you a simple answer. But you know, I love the saying. It goes something like, I forget what it is now. If I say something I love, but something like wisdom comes from experience, and experience comes from mistakes. Something like that. I don't have it quite right. Maybe some of you remember how it goes. But the idea being that trial and error, you know, a lot of what we learn is from not doing it quite right. And then we learn from that, and the next time we maybe do it better. So you wanted a better answer, but that's... I don't think you're going to get one. Yes, one more, and then I want to say something. Yeah.
I have two questions. The first is, I still find this incredibly difficult, challenging, frustrating, all of those things. What is the longest that you know of somebody has stuck with it before they either started seeing some benefit or felt that they were making progress?
You mean what's the outermost limit before someone started saying...
Yeah, what that you know of. I need hope.
We need hope. Well, I don't know. Some people see the benefits right away, and some people it's really slow and it takes a long time before it comes... Some people never see their benefits from directly in meditation. Like, meditation is never so pleasant for them. They never get calm. Their mind never quiets down, and so they don't see that doesn't seem to be any proof that they're meditating well. But it makes a difference in their life, And the rest of their life goes a lot smoother because they do that meditation, you know, this the poor meditation, so-called poor. So there's so many different ways in which it works. So there's a few things. I think the benefits you'll see in it come quicker if you really understand what the practice is, how it works. And it's not so easy to understand it, actually. So sometimes it helps to talk to someone who, like someone who's been practicing for a while, a teacher or someone, and really make sure that you understand what the idea is. Because people have, even though, you know, you might hear good teaching, it often gets confused how we hear it. And so people will, are not quite doing it as simply as it's supposed to be or applying it in the way. So, but to answer your kind of outermost limit question, I'll tell you a story of one of my heroes. There was a man who came to our group for a long time, beautiful man, who sat a lot of retreats. And he went to practice in Asia. He went and practiced different meditation centers around the country here. And it was clear that he was really devoted to the practice. He really believed in the practice. He really was giving his best. And he did a fair number of retreats with me as well. And it was always a struggle for him. It was amazing, the struggles he had, the physical pain he had sitting. And, you know, he didn't seem to get any of the benefits of calm and relaxation and bliss that some people can get. And his mind was always churning away and busy. And then he sat a retreat with me, a long retreat. And, you know, I saw him regularly for interviews, and I gave him the best advice I could, best support I could. And I'd known him for some years now, by now, and I was thinking to myself, gee, I don't think this is working for this man. I think maybe it's my responsibility to tell him, you know, I think it's not working. I think you should try something else. But, you know, but he had so much faith, you know, so much devotion, you know, to it. And, you know, I said, well, that's a dangerous thing for a meditation teacher to say. I mean, that's really what pulled the rug from underneath his faith. And, you know, so I can't say that, you know, but maybe I should, since having, you know, I was debated in my mind, but I didn't say anything. And but he had a hard retreat. And then 6 months later, he came to me and said, Gil, remember that retreat that I sat with you that was so hard? That turned out to be one of the most important things in my life. Because I learned from that how to be present for difficult states, difficult experiences. And my life, my regular life outside of meditation, which normally was somewhat comfortable, became difficult. I forget what happened to him. But I knew how to be with it because of what I learned in that retreat. And it made such a big difference for me. And in fact, he's kept it up. And I don't think he's a great meditator, but there's a calm and acceptance and openness in him that is kind of blooming more and more all the time. But for him, in that situation, it was years before he saw, at least I could see anything. So that happens, you know, outer range. Most people, it's sooner. And so, in fact, if you don't see any, if you do it regularly, meditation regularly for 6 months, and you don't see any benefits for yourself in a regular practice for 6 months, then you can do one of two things I recommend. One is try not meditating for a couple of weeks and compare what your life is like. And see, you know, maybe then you'll see, oh, I didn't realize how beneficial it is. And now that I was not doing it, I realize it. That's one thing. The other thing to do is to go talk to a meditation teacher and explore with them a little bit what's happening in your meditation, and maybe you need some help or guidance or support. One of the important things to learn, if you want to learn how to benefit from it quickly, is learn how to be relaxed about frustration. Maybe that's the first step. You know, this is not going the way I expected to go or what I wanted to go, so maybe I have to learn patience. Then maybe that's the first lesson. So, for different people, it's a very profound path, this path of paying careful attention, paying mindful attention to your life. It's your life. It isn't like I'm suggesting that some esoteric, strange thing. It's paying more careful attention to your life as it shows up. Even in meditation, you're letting this to show up. And it's a profound thing to begin seeing more deeply who you are as it appears. And we're all different, and we're all different from each other, from ourselves at different times. But I have tremendous faith, trust, in the value of being present for our life. And that what happens when we start opening up and being present for it, as opposed to ignore it or distract ourselves or whatever we do. And so at different times, it's different things. So sometimes there'll be a lot of emotions, sometimes very little. Sometimes physical things happen in meditation that need your attention. Sometimes it's not physical at all. Sometimes there's a lot of bliss. Sometimes a lot of something else. Sometimes you seem to have great insight and understanding, and sometimes it seems very flat. And I've learned from all these years of meditation to not only to be okay with whatever happens, but to trust, kind of like trust, that if it's happening, it's meant to happen. And my job is just to be present, to be mindful. And then, so we're learning how to be mindful of it all. Now, in order to take, so then some people want to understand after a course like this, how do I go further with it? Which is kind of your question earlier. And so what I want to do is to cover three different areas. One is concentration, the other is wisdom, and the third is applying this practice into daily life. The concentration is important because classically, the mindfulness I've been teaching you is coupled with, joined together with, a stability of mind, a steadiness of mind that comes with concentration. And so sometimes it's helpful to cultivate a more concentrated mind or a more still mind so that that still mind can have more clear mindfulness. It's kind of like, you know, if you take a telescope in your hand and you're going to look, you know, at the moon or a star, you know, something, or Venus or something, you know, you can't hold, in your hands, you can't hold it still enough. And you need to put the telescope on a tripod to hold it still enough to be able to see an object far away. So the same thing sometimes with our mind. The mind has to be still enough so that it can see deeply or see clearly. And so the concentration factor is the tripod. It creates that stability so the mindfulness can be, you know, not be wobbly. And so there's a number of ways of developing concentration. One way is regularity of practice. If you just practice every day, or at least 6 days a week, every day, just slowly, but the regularity and the continuity, the mind will start becoming more stable, more steady, and the kind of concentration will come along with the mindfulness practice. Another way is to put aside the mindfulness practice for a while, the way I've taught it, and only stay with the breath for a while. Just do breath meditation. And not, you know, if something else happens, don't pay attention to it, like the way I said. Just stay with the breath, come back to the breath, be with the breath. Because when you have only a single focus for attention, that is a way of cultivating, strengthening concentration. And some people need that. If the mind is really scattered, and you know, maybe that's what you need before you can really be mindful in the way I've been talking about. So it's time when well spent. Just cultivating concentration and developing that muscle, the concentration muscle, for a while. The third way of developing concentration is doing the meditation practice on retreat. And our particular Buddhist tradition puts a lot of emphasis on going on retreat. We like to think of it kind of like, you know, that all cultures have had some way in which people spend 40 days in the desert or went on a vision quest or, you know, somehow stepped out of their usual life in order to experience themselves in a deeper way, or experience the sacred or something. So for us, this is called retreats. And these are either sometimes day-long retreats, weekend retreats, week-long retreats, month-long retreats, silent retreats, where the primary thing we do throughout the day is do meditation practice, and many hours a day. And there, because of the continuity of the practice, the regularity of the practice, and there's And because we're not doing anything else, we're not distracted by the phone or the email or the computer or work or relationships or conversations with other people. It allows the mind to gather and get collected so that a very strong stability develops, and so the mindfulness can be quite strong. It's easier to be in the present moment. So it's often helpful to have concentration, and those are the three kind of primary ways in which we cultivate in our tradition as part of it. Being on meditation retreats is a beautiful thing to do. I like to say that it's my wish that everyone, at least once in a lifetime, do a 10-day silent meditation retreat. It's really something. It's a whole different way of knowing yourself, knowing what it is to be a human being, a whole different perspective on life from the vantage point of 10 days of being on a silent meditation retreat. Even if you don't meditate well, it doesn't matter. Just being on it is good. So part of the value of having a little more concentration and stability is so the mindfulness can be stronger and see more deeply. And what that means in our tradition is to see on the other side of our concepts of things. Concepts are kind of things we paint over. We have this concept here at IMC that this is a bell. I remember once in San Francisco, I was driving downtown San Francisco, and there was someone who was begging for money, I suppose. And I almost went back. I was driving by and I looked. I think I was stopped for the light. I looked at what he was holding. And I realized he was holding a beautiful brass Japanese bell. Did he not understand what he was holding? And I almost went back and offered to buy it. Because that bell must have a really good sound. But it wasn't a bell for him. For him, it was a begging bowl. My teacher in Burma, he had something that looked about this shape and this size. It was not a bell. It was a spittoon, which he used regularly. We say now it's a bell. It's also nice and metal. I can imagine someone making it into a pot and making oatmeal or having a meal in it. Or monks will eat out of bowls that are a little bit bigger than this. But this, you can do many things with this, right? So what is it? There's the bell in this. This is not inherently a bell. It's a bell because we functionally use it as a bell. The bell is a concept we put over it. And so there's many, many things in our life where we have a concept of it which is not inherent in the situation. Now we call this a meditation center. Before us it was called a church. The building hasn't changed much. But it's how it's being used. It's the concepts we relate to. And so concepts, are one thing. And then we can see behind the concepts and see the experience for what it is directly for itself. So I can see the hardness of this, like the metal of it, the shape of it, the texture of it, the color of it. I can see all those things. And then I can, if I'm still enough, I can also see how in the perception of this object, how the mind constructs the concept bell or spittoon or bowl or begging bowl or whatever it might be. Make some sense? So part of the value of concentrated mindfulness is so we don't always see things through our concepts, we start seeing things more directly. So I want to give you an example of how this works. So I'll hold up a flower. So just a flower, right? You all see the flower? So it's a flower. And flowers are usually considered kind of beautiful and nice and special. And so here's just a flower. And so, big deal, flower, okay? Just a flower. And we talk about seeing the flower, you just see the thusness of the flower, they say in Buddhism, the suchness of the flower, just the flowerness of the flower. Just the flower in itself, right? Now watch this. So now I'm holding up a second flower. And now this is a small flower, right, compared to the big one. Okay, so you can see both of them. So now I can say something I couldn't say before. Now I can say big flower, small flower. See? Right? Great. That's pretty straightforward. Big, small. Now watch as I do this magic trick. And you can watch the sleight of hand. You need to, okay, see? This is big, right? And this is small. The right hand is big, right? So it hasn't gone anywhere. Still my right hand. So now, the one in my right hand is the small flower. And the one in my left hand is the big one. You see that? You see the magic? Isn't that amazing? Isn't that quite amazing? Just like that. It was small and now it's big. How did I do that? Small and big does not reside in the flower. It resides in the mind that compares it to something. It's a concept. The flowerness of the flower, the suchness of the flower, does not reside in the comparison. Why is this important? Because most of the suffering that people experience about themselves is because they're comparing themselves to something. And they're not allowing themselves to experience their thusness, their flowerness, their personness. Just allowing themselves to be as they are. And I can remember very well, you know, all the comparisons I did as a teenager. It was painful. My hair was too short, my hair was too long, my, you know, this and that, my nose, my forehead, my, you know, all, you know, people, so many comparisons. And then, you know, we compare our body parts. You know, most people have some kind of suffering around their body parts. It's not quite right, right? Not quite right compared to what and to who? Too short, too tall, too this and that. And then, you know, there's our personality and there are all kinds of things. And we get caught up in this world of concepts and ideas. And because of that, we sometimes don't have the peace that comes just letting ourselves just be. And we don't really see ourselves that deeply. If you're only seeing yourself in comparison, you're seeing yourself partially. So what happens in meditation is we begin slowly over time becoming calmer and more settled and no longer seeing through the filter of our concepts and our ideas. And we start seeing more deeply what's actually there in and of itself. And it becomes much more interesting and much more profound, and allows for more profound aspects of ourselves to come forth. One of the things that allows to come forth is greater sense of freedom. Chances are there's not much freedom if you're stuck in this world here, comparison. But if you so that's the wisdom, that's an example of the kind of wisdom that our tradition puts a lot of emphasis on. The wisdom that comes from going behind or underneath the concepts and seeing our experience directly for what it is. It becomes a kind of a different experience. And there's a variety of kind of deeper understandings of our life that are only possible when we can see beyond the filter of these concepts and ideas we have. And so even ideas like, you know, I'm an old person or a young person, I'm a man or a woman, I'm married or I'm single, or I have too many friends, or I have no friends. All those, you know, there might be some truth to them in a way, but they're all comparisons and concepts. And people get stuck in them and spin around in them. But it's actually possible to put those to rest. It's possible to have an experience of being alive, vital, without those concepts and ideas operating. So that's the wisdom part. And then there's the aspect of bringing this practice into our daily life. So a lot of that has to do with, it's not a big esoteric thing. It's basically finding value and meaning in paying more careful attention to what's happening in the present moment as you do your daily life. Just noticing more often. And it doesn't have to be so dramatic. It can be as simple as you maybe have important things to think about and do and whatever, and you're driving your car, and you come to a red light. Maybe for the number of seconds that the light is red, you use that as an opportunity to check in. What's actually happening here and now in the present moment? As opposed to what's going to happen at work when I get there or that conversation I had yesterday or whatever. Just what's happening now? And then only then will you notice that you're kind of tense as you're driving. And maybe you don't need to be so tense. Maybe you can relax. Or you realize you have certain emotions. Or what I do sometimes when a phone rings, I try not to answer the phone too quickly. Mm-hmm. Even though often I feel, I don't know if you feel this, but there seems to be this biological imperative to answer the phone with the least possible number of rings, even though most people will let it ring for a number of times before they give up. And so I try to let it ring for a couple of rings, and I use that as a time to be curious and what's happening now? Let's find out. Let's be present and mindful of what's happening now. And then I'm in a better space to have the conversation on the phone because I've checked in with myself. I know how I'm feeling. And so then, if I don't know how I'm feeling, then, I might say something I shouldn't say or something. So, simple example. Or if you come into a new building or a new room, maybe that transition is a time to just check in. What's happening here? What's going on with me? What's going on around me? As opposed to being involved in our concepts and ideas, our thoughts and feelings, just kind of caught up in our little inner drama. So there's a lot of opportunities throughout the day to simply check out what's going on now. What's happening now? Some people find that it's helpful to do this more often than not. To check in more often and make a regular habit of doing this. And there's a number of ways to develop it into a habit or a regular thing. One way is to have regular reminders. I've known people who've had mindfulness bells, they had something, a chime that goes off, and, especially if you're on your computer doing important web searching. it's so important. And so you're lost in your thing, and then ding! Oh, I'm hunched over, I'm straining, I'm frustrated. And then you notice that, and you say, most people don't say, oh, yeah, that's happening, I'm hunched over, I'm frustrated, I'm straining. Let's just do a better job at it. Most people see that, and they say, okay, let's sit up and let's relax, So the mindfulness bell is a reminder to kind of that inserts itself in the middle of our life where we're often caught up. Some people like that. Some people have other reminders, like I have the telephone bell or something. I've known people who've put stickers, little dot stickers, on every light switch in their house. And every time they're going to switch the light on or off, they see the sticker. And it says, okay, be mindful. Notice what's going on here and now. As opposed to kind of continuing your merry thinking. Some people like to choose particular tasks, like for a week or a few days, and make that kind of a more focused to be mindful while they do the task. So it could be washing dishes. That while you wash the dishes, that you're going to do the same things as you do in meditation. You're going to really be there for the dishes, like you would really be there for your breath. The mind wanders off from the dishes, you come back to the dishes. You start thinking about something else. Just like in meditation, you let go of those thoughts and you come back to just do dishes. Just be there fully for the dishes. And experiment what it's like to just do dishes. So I'll tell you a story of, I hope I haven't told you this, I don't think so. It's an occupational hazard of teaching too much. Don't remember where I said things. One of the great teachers in our American insight meditation tradition is a woman named Kamala Masters. And she lives in Hawaii. And she raised, as a single mom, four kids. At some point in raising her four kids, she was able to get away to go to a meditation retreat with an Indian insight meditation teacher. And And at the end of the retreat, he gave a little instruction, say it's really important to continue meditating every day. Everyone should meditate every day. So she went up to him and said, I can't do that. And he said, oh, everybody should meditate. Everybody can do that. He was kind of like a monk, this guy, so he didn't know about life. Or this part of life. So he said, everybody can meditate every day. It's just a matter of just making a decision, being a little disciplined, and you can always carve out time. And she said, no, I can't do it. And so he didn't understand. So she had the brilliance of saying, okay, come and stay with me for some days. So he came and stayed at her house, you know, with four kids and school and lunches and everything that they had to do. And after some days, he came to her and said, you're right. You can't meditate. He said, but what I'll teach you to do then, I'll teach you how to be mindful in the activities you do. And he would be next to her when she was in the sink washing the dishes. She had to wash dishes, right? Or make those lunches. And he would show her how to be really fully present for that activity and to have the mindfulness right there, just for that. And of course, the mind wanders off, but that's a training, is to come back and be there for that. And then he said in her house, there's a hallway that connected all the different rooms. It wasn't a very big hallway, I think. But he said, this hallway, you walk through this hallway all the time. Every time you step into this hallway, let this hallway be your mindfulness meditation hall. So do walking meditation. And I think, Don, you have the handout for walking meditation there? So somewhere there's a handout about we have instructions for doing walking meditation. And so every time she stepped in there, she had to go there anyway. It wasn't like taking time away from her. But she would enter and she would try to be mindful of the few steps she took in the hallway before she went into the next activity. Check in with herself, know what's going on. So it's nice. What's even nicer is that she did that for a number of years. She couldn't go back on any more retreats. And at some point, her kids were old enough that she could go back on a long retreat. And on that, her first retreat, her meditation went so deep that she, like this, you know, she matured or developed her meditation very, very quickly that, that people hadn't seen someone do it that quickly. And partly because she had done so much strong, good practice every day at home that she was primed for what happened on retreat. And now she's really a great teacher, great practitioner. So some people, will choose different activities over the time. So like 1 week it might be walking from where you park your car to your place of work and do walking meditation. Or it might be that every time you go to the bathroom, you sit in the bathroom for a little bit extra and just be mindful. No one's going to ask what's going on. Or it could be when you wash the dishes for a week. Or it could be for a week you choose one meal a day to eat in silence and eat mindfully. To really be present for the experience of eating and not let your mind wander off so much, just come back, be there in silence. Or it could be that, cleaning the house or, it could be all kinds of things. And if you choose different things over different weeks, slowly over time, more and more of you have more and more association, understanding what it's like to be mindful for different things. And it's not like you have to be that acutely mindful of everything you do all the time, but to bring more mindfulness into your life is a wonderful protection from building up stress. It's a wonderful support for seeing more deeply and understanding ourselves more deeply. It's a wonderful aid to letting some of the best qualities of who you are as a person to come forth, because you have more space and time to choose to do that if you're mindful than if you're in a reactive mode. It's a really wonderful thing to do, to practice in daily life. If you practice in daily life, it supports and makes it easier to practice in meditation. If you practice in meditation, it's easier to practice in daily life. They support each other. It's a beautiful thing back and forth. So any questions about that? Yes.
Yeah, thanks. I remember on the one of your handouts a few weeks ago, you had suggested that we pick an activity and once a week do it in mindfulness. And so I was, you had suggested driving, which I thought was pretty crazy, and I tried it with driving. And sure enough, I was 70 miles an hour down the freeway mindfully. I thought it was a kind of a strange thing. But I also
usually you're 70 miles an hour and mindless?
Yes, more or less. Yeah, exactly.
Don't drive near me.
Exactly. And I did find that it kind of entered into the rest of my life. I found that the mindfulness practice was entering. But I guess my question was, a lot of times I would find it boring, irritating. I would, why do I have to do this? I'd much rather be, you know, stressing about something. And so I guess my question is, why is it that the things that drive me crazy, the rumination and the stressful thinking, I'm so drawn to, and why something which would be good for me I find irritating? And so I guess I'm wondering, like, where does that attachment come from?
It's a great question, and the only person who can answer that is you. And so, and that's one of the functions of mindfulness practice, is to be mindful of that whole experience of attachment, of drive, of wanting, of impatience. And it takes patience to feel the impatience. It takes patience to feel this is boring and not valuable. There's more important things to do. And not try to fix it, but just be present and look at it. Let it show itself. Get to know it more. And then sooner or later, you start seeing what's driving it. And I don't know you. It could be a lot of things can drive that. And all of them are, you're probably, all of them are short-sighted. You can do everything you need to do in your life beautifully without being attached. And it comes from a different source of motivation. But you have to answer that question for yourself. And it takes time and interest to keep looking and bringing up the question and exploring it.
So those reasons for attachment vary from person to person. There's no universal.
I think it's best, yes, to assume it's different for every person. I mean, there's common themes that a lot of people share, but you're not that unique.
Yeah, I've seen worse drivers.
So as we come to the end here, regularity of practice is really helpful for meditation, and one of the things that's really also helpful as part of regularity is from time to time to go sit with other people, meditate with other people. There's something that happens when meditating with other people that's very supportive. We learn a lot by osmosis just being with other meditators. There's something, a variety of things we pick up just in this kind of a silent space. Somehow the posture, the support, their enthusiasm. It's helpful to know that you're not the only one who's weird. You know, there are other people who are doing this as well, because some people have no one else in their life who does anything like this, and everyone else is looking, you know, like you're like cross-eyed at you, like, what, you meditate? And so it's good to know that some other people do it. It's kind of settling and reassuring. And there's, you know, sitting groups all over the place. Palo Alto, Mountain View, San Jose, not so difficult to find. You're welcome to come here to us. IMC is set up a little bit intentionally to be informal, meaning so that it's easy, relatively easy for people to come and go as they wish. And so please feel welcome to come here anytime. We have a full schedule of activities throughout the week. Maybe some of that would work for you. And in that, it's easy to come and go. You can come only for, you know, I think almost everything we do, you can come for part of it. You don't have to come for the whole thing. So if you just want to come meditate with us, like Monday evening we have meditation, then a talk, you could just come for the meditation and leave. You know, you don't have to, or you can just come for the talk if you don't want to meditate. You know, it's, you know, this place here is meant to serve people in whatever way that you find it helpful. We have no membership here at IMC. We're an all-volunteer organization. We try to keep it relaxed. We try not to, And we don't charge for anything. We try to keep the expenses down. We don't have staff. It's all done by volunteers here. And so having membership is kind of a little bit, you know, we have to keep track of it, right? And that takes work. So what I like to say is that if you would like to be a member, consider yourself a member. If you don't feel like, you know, if you don't believe in this membership thing, it's like, you know, it's getting too close, like, you know, it's too religious, then just be reassured we don't do membership here. Whatever's helpful for you. We have a newsletter that you can pick up if you haven't. It has our schedule and activities and things. There's my book. If you haven't picked one up, you can get a copy of it. We offer it freely. So I think that's the main things I should say. Anything, any questions or anything that I'm being left out that would be helpful at this point?
I came several Sundays ago for a Sunday sitting, and it was a little weird just coming here and having not paid anything, and it seemed very, very generous and very, very, it was a great, great experience. I just encourage everyone to come and take advantage of this, and you're going to feel a little weird because you're used to paying for things and used to signing up and having schedules, and just to have this offered for anyone to come and enjoy and take advantage of, just it takes a little getting over that, but when you come here, it's a great experience.
Great, that's beautiful. Thank you. I love hearing that. Yeah, it's a little bit, you know, if it's the first time coming to our regular events, it's, you know, since there's no one taking money or greeting you, it's like, you know, it's like not so clear. What are you supposed to do? You know, it's not clear that you're in or what's going on. And there are people who come here for months or years and don't talk to anyone. And some people are, you know, if you would like to talk to someone, but it's a basically a friendly community. So it doesn't take that long if you make little effort. But if you're shy, then it might take longer. But some people love it this way. There are people who've come here for years and I don't know their name. No one knows their name. They've never talked to anyone. They sit there in the back row. They come and they say, "This is the only place I know where I can be in. I can kind of be in public this way, and nothing's asked of me. And I can come here and I can relax and settle, and it's very meaningful for me. I don't need anything from anybody. Actually, this is the one place where I don't want to be interactive." And if you're someone who's much more engaged, kind of like to be engaged. Some people, you know, the first time they're here, everybody knows they're here. And like Victor here, how long did you come here before you started volunteering and made yourself known? I bet it wasn't very long.
It was pretty quick.
Like?
I don't know.
Yeah.
It was a while ago.
A while ago, yeah. I think Victor was kind of, you know, it didn't take long.
We needed somebody to do this.
Yes. Yes, I have three books that are available. Only one of them is offered for free, and that's the one, the issue at hand. The other are for sale. That's the way, you know. I apologize. No. We have a policy here not to sell things here. We try to keep this a commercial-free zone. Yeah, you can get it from Amazon. And actually, one is called The Monastery Within, A Monastery Within, and it's a small book with a lot of short teaching stories that I've kind of made up for purposes of teaching, and I think they're nice, and that's why I put them in the book. And that's only available on, well, not only on Amazon, but it's kind of like a print-on-demand or e-book kind of thing. So you can get it from Amazon.
I have a
question.
Yeah. Why isn't the Dharmapada on as an e-book?
So also the other thing I've done is I've translated one of the most classic set of teachings from the Buddha called the Dhammapada. It's a series of verses, and that's published by Shambhala, a regular publisher. And why they haven't made it an ebook, I don't know. They've had it for almost 8 years now, and you think they'd get on with it in the modern world. But I don't know. I don't know the answer. I asked them many years ago, and they said, "Oh, we're exploring how to do it," or something. Yes.
Did you just say they haven't made it in a book?
Oh, the Dhammapada is a book, but they have not made it into an e-book.
Oh,
a Kindle or, you know, iPad.
I just checked it out from the library at Foster City.
Dhammapada, they have it in Foster City? Great.
You're
get it from the library. It's good. So, so please feel welcome to come here. And some of the things we do here are a little bit more easier maybe for beginners or new people to get to. So like Thursday evening, the Thursday evening sitting, the meditation, I think generally the talks and the discussion is more focused a little bit more on beginner kind of topics. And also the sitting, the meditation is not so long. I think it's 30 minutes. And so it's easier for 30 minutes. The Monday evening, the meditation is 45 minutes long. If you do come to you know any of the sittings, you know, and if you're not used to sitting 45 minutes, you know, you can always sit in the back and leave. You can always open your eyes and look at the ceiling. You know, it's just don't make a lot of noise and don't start talking on your phone, or do email. Yes.
If we miss one class, do you have a handout for past class?
Yes. If you talk to Dawn there, she'll give you the past handouts. And also the handout, all the handouts are on the web. You know, if the Audio Dharma is where we have all these recordings of these talks, and next to the recordings is the PDF for the handouts. So I hope you enjoy your mindfulness. I like to think that if you enjoy mindfulness, it means you enjoy your life. That's all it is being mindful of your life. So thank you.